Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, Episode 161, Ronald Allen, Minimal Rationality and the Law of Evidence. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Ed Chang from Vanderbilt Law School. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. This week, our guest is Ron Allen. Ron is the John Henry Wigmore Professor of Law at Northwestern University. Ron, of course, is one of the best-known scholars in evidence and proof, and among other things, has worked with Tanzania and China in formulating their evidence codes. Our podcast today features Ron's new article, Minimal Rationality and the Law of Evidence, which was co-authored with Mike Pardo, William Lawrence, and Chris Smiklis. It's forthcoming in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology. In it, Ron and his co-authors suggest that the existing law of evidence seeks to promote a minimal level of rationality in legal decision-making. This is in contrast to maximalist theories of evidence, which, as the name implies, try to maximize the rationality or accuracy of legal proceedings. In other words, under a minimalist approach, the rules of evidence try to cut out the worst of our fact-finding tendencies, but largely leave the fact finder and the adversarial system to their own devices. This is quite different from what we evidence scholars often try to do, which is to push the legal system to be its best self. My conversation with Ron explores this distinction between maximalist and minimalist theories of evidence, why minimalist best describes our current system, and perhaps whether that's a good or bad thing. Ron, delighted to have you on Excited Utterance. Welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Ed. I hope all is well with you.
So your paper contrasts two big conceptual visions of evidence law. One where the purpose of evidence law is basically to ensure minimal rationality in decision-making, and the other where the purpose is to ensure maximal rationality. Now, before getting to your thesis, I thought maybe you could just take a moment to explain these two models, maximal and minimal, and how they're different.
Well, for 100 years, there's been a view among evidence scholars in particular that the law of evidence is designed to increase rationality and accuracy at trial by ensuring the best evidence is presented, or at least really good evidence is presented to a jury, and bad evidence is kept out. The idea that the law of evidence, which is again a conventional idea, as you know, is a set of tight exclusionary rules that are designed to do that, is conventional. What we have shown, I believe, is that that is just false. And what is actually true is that the law of evidence does very little in terms of affecting the quantity or quality of evidence that goes before a fact finder, and that a better explanation, and that's, by the way, what this is, Ed, it's, in our opinion, a better explanation of a complex dynamic, is that it's pursuing minimal rationality. It provides very, very minimal guardrails. And to the extent the rationality accuracy is pursued at trial, it's almost exclusively done through the operation of the adversary system. Now, let me say, I provide, as you know, explanations, not theories. This isn't much of a theory, but it is, I think, a powerful explanation. It brings together a whole series of disparate issues, disparate elements, and puts them in a new light and makes sense of them. Whereas if you look at the law of evidence from the point of view of actually pursuing rectitude of decision, accuracy, and so on and so forth, it makes no sense at all.
So let me ask you to give us a little more in terms of specifics. So what is it about the existing proof system? And it's not just the rules of evidence in your paper. What is it about the existing system that screams minimalist, or why is minimalist the better descriptive term?
Why it's a better descriptive term is the collation of all the various points that we make in the paper, but some examples are just obvious and just cry out. What's the definition of relevancy? Essentially, evidence is relevant if any rational person could be influenced in an act of consequence. That's not saying you have to have good evidence or bad evidence. You can have any evidence as long as that criteria is met. The constraint on that in 403, I mean, we're talking the federal rules of evidence, obviously, federal law, the constraint on that is hardly a constraint at all. First of all, a judge doesn't have to, but may exclude evidence if that person is convinced that the prejudicial effect substantially outweighs the probative value. That's none of that is saying anything about the quality of the evidence, except a very minimal standard and a very hard to reach constraint in the language of prejudicial effect. Or take another example. As you know, a couple articles I've written have the title something like the hearsay rule is a rule of admission. When you look at the federal law of evidence, there are only two serious exclusionary rules, hearsay rule and the character evidence rule. The hearsay rule was a complex exclusionary rule. That's the English common law. But for 200 years, almost unbroken, two small exceptions, exception after exception after exception has been added to it. The hearsay rule is a rule of admission. It's become a rule of admission, not a rule of exclusion. Take the character evidence rule. That's the second of the big exclusionary rules. And I call these, by the way, the two unredeemed promises in the federal rules of evidence. They promise to exclude, and yet they don't. Character evidence, as you know, is exactly the same way, maybe not as fulsome in terms of the exceptions, but there are an awful lot of them. And as you also know, 404B is the most litigated rule of evidence in the law of evidence, which basically allows people to avoid the character evidence rule by advancing all kinds of propensity evidence. You look elsewhere in the law of evidence and you don't see exclusionary rules that are advancing rationality. I mean, look at the rest of Article 404. There are exclusionary rules there, but they exclude positive evidence, good evidence, for other policies. So that hardly is an argument in favor of maximal rationality. Everywhere you look, you see the same thing, Ed. You see very few constraints. And I haven't even gotten to the most important point, which the law of evidence, it's pretty stunning, has overlooked, which is that the reality of the legal system is the master of the case and party presentation principles.
I was actually going to raise those, that in addition to the rules, which is often what I think we excessively emphasize, one of the nice things about your paper is that you talk about party-driven evidence as another example of why it's minimal. And you also talk about sufficiency standards, which also seem to be about minimalism. So maybe you can talk more about that.
Yeah. So the idea that the law of evidence structures the trials in this kind of detailed way and regulate inputs and the law of procedure, I guess you'd say, regulates the outputs. I mean, that's what we're talking about, the inputs being the law of evidence, the outputs being sufficiency determinations and things like that. As I've just gone through, is just wrong. The reality is that every single jurisdiction where we've been able to find law embraces what's called the master of the case principle. The parties are masters of their case. Somebody else might think that the evidence that they're presenting is not the best evidence. Well, that's too bad. As long as the evidence they're presenting meets the minimal standards of things like 401, 403, whatever, it can come in. If the party wants to engage in a suicidal mission on some procedural issue, they can do it and the judges aren't going to save them. Put aside things like former improper cases and things like that. But outside of that and what you might call normal litigation, the parties can pretty much do whatever they like. And then, of course, party presentation is the supplement to that. They can present it the way they like, again, subject to minimal requirements of firsthand knowledge and things of that sort.
So is Daubert your hardest case? It seems to me that Rule 702, at least in its original form, was probably minimal rationality. But 702 post-Daubert, and certainly Daubert in the hands of certain courts, that seems to me to be taking at least more of a maximalist approach, if not a maximalist approach.
Yeah. So I think Daubert and expert testimony is a really interesting topic. And go back to the point that I made that what we're offering here is an explanation of a huge sprawling canvas. Not every single aspect of it is going to be perfectly explainable by this explanation. From our point of view, the issue is whether overall it's an overwhelming case. I think overall it is an overwhelming case. Now, how does Daubert fit into that? As you know, Ed, I identified this, what I think is the crucial conceptual problem in expert testimony, the difference between deference and education. In my opinion, Daubert took an appropriate first step by seeming to require judges to become educated, but they didn't take the next step and they still haven't taken the next step. which is requiring that evidence be presented to a jury in a way that can be understood by the lay people on that jury. Now, what do you actually get in practice when you think about this distinction between minimal and maximal? And by the way, I would say it's a spectrum. And Daubert is, I agree with you, away from the far end of minimalism towards the other end of the spectrum. But what's the standard litigation, Ed? It's the standard litigation is two experts saying the opposite things, decided by a jury who lacks expertise and competence, which is why you are, I think, writing a book about this matter. That does not strike me as maximal rationality. Correct me if you think that's wrong, but it looks to me like quite irrational, actually, where you have equally qualified experts providing opinions in particular that are directly in contradiction to each other. A maximal approach would be what? It would be the judges would be deciding whose expert is right and what the expertise is and doing whatever, you know, directing verdicts, taking judicial notice or whatever. But we don't do that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that the battle of the experts problem and the way we resolve it, which is to ask unqualified jurors to decide it, is actually a minimalist approach. We only want them to do the bare minimum, at least as of now. That's an interesting perspective on this. Let me push you a little bit on your spectrum. One thought I had was that rather than just describing the current setup as one that was much more about minimal rationality, you could take your dichotomy or your spectrum between maximalist and minimalist approaches and use it as a description to explain a lot of the disputes in our field. So seems to me that one of the issues about Daubert, or one of the controversies about Daubert, is between those who would rather just police the extreme fringes, which is a minimalist approach, and those who want a lot more judicial policing, which, as you just described, is a maximalist approach. So is there promise in the theory here, not only as a descriptive matter for the rules of evidence as they stand, but also to describe what's really going on when we have pitch battles in our field?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And I think this paper is going to stir the waters in that regard, largely because obviously I'm an enthusiast for our paper. And I think the case we make is overwhelming in terms of what the reality is. And there are going to be a lot of people who are not happy about this normatively. Maybe you're one of them, actually, with your arguments about consensus in expert testimony. Your colleague here on these excellent podcasts, Alex Nunn, as you know, thinks I'm right, but thinks it's terrible that I'm right, and has a paper coming out explaining why we should take a fundamentally different approach. Everyone who argues for this law, or this rule of evidence, or that rule of evidence, or let's amend this, or let's amend that, and that, as you know, is typical fare in our field, is being driven, even though they may not have been consciously aware of it, by a maximalist approach. I think those are all going to fail in terms of effect on the real world. And it's interesting to note that after hundreds and hundreds of articles about why this rule of evidence should be amended or this one adopted or whatever, the Federal Advisory Committee doesn't do any of that. And I think I can explain that if you want to talk about it. I think it's an interesting phenomenon in itself. So I suspect that there will be a lot of pushback normatively about this, saying that this may be right, but it's a shame. I don't think it's a shame, but there you are.
Well, let me take you up on the invitation. Why is it that it's hard to impose anything but a minimalist approach in this space? And why do you think the advisory committee sticks to that?
Well, first of all, I would never say progress can't be made. Perhaps people can come up with really good ideas and important ideas and ones that work. The most important word in the sentences that I've just uttered is work. The reason for the acoustic separation between standard conventional evidence scholarship in the Federal Rules Committee is that standard conventional scholarship misappraises the thing that they are theorizing about. And that is the nature of the educational regime, the foundations of the field of evidence. That field deals with, and you know that I'm under the influence of complexity theory, that deals with, in my terms, complex adaptive systems. They're resistant to regulation by rule. And when you try to regulate them, you get unanticipated consequences. I suspect, even though I doubt any members of the advisory committee are thinking in these terms, that implicitly they are, and that's why they say leave well enough alone. You have this complex process out there that percolates along, seems to be working, and what we don't want to do is, to use my favorite metaphor, introduce rabbits into Australia. But I do think what may be intriguing about this work, and this is consistent with other things that I've done, as you know, is the point that I just made, that I believe that some of us are misconceiving the object of our inquiry. We're misconceiving what actually happens at evidence and what the law of evidence actually is. It may simply be that people get it and understand it and object to it, but I don't think so. I think they think that you can actually regulate inference. And that takes me to what is the most fundamental point here. I don't think you can regulate inference very effectively by rule for the reasons we've just identified. The inferential process ranges over the entire human condition. The idea that a priori you could come up with rules that tell people how to draw inferences here, there, and other places is just problematic.
So it's kind of funny. Before the interview, we were joking, or at least I was joking, that I was going to ask you to be normative. And I wasn't sure whether I was going to get a normative position out of you. But I think I just heard a normative position, which is that you think that because inference is a complex adaptive system, it is actually very difficult to regulate inference in a maximalist way. And that therefore, perhaps, the minimalist regime that we have is normatively desirable. Am I putting words in your mouth, or is that right?
Yeah, Ed, my old friend, and I, were you ever my student? You were never my student, were you?
I was not your student, but you might remember that at Northwestern, I was a very, very baby professor there.
I do remember that. Yes, you're putting words in my mouth. I am describing, and I'm describing I like the term, the acoustic separation between evidence, conventional evidence scholarship, and the real cooperation of the system. Look, you know, I'm trained in mathematics. Algorithms are great when they work, but the algorithms are not great when they don't work. And you have to pick the tool for the task. My guess is, it's a guess, that the holy grail of computer science, which is to create a machine that can reason like a human, is never going to work. And even if it did, you wouldn't be able to input all the data necessary for it to be a fact-finding, law-deciding machine. But on the other hand, if you want to try, I encourage you to try. With you, I get a lot of papers from young scholars in particular, and I try to be helpful and don't try to convince them not to engage in what they're doing. I mean, go for it. And maybe at the end of the day, they'll be right. But that's actually my attitude. Maybe at the end of the day, they'll be right. Prove me wrong that evidence scholarship or evidence rules or any way in which you could regulate inference would work in any kind of beneficial way.
Final question for you. What's next for this project? Or perhaps you touched on this already. How does this project fit into your broader work on complex adaptive systems and inference?
Well, for the last couple of decades, I've been excavating or trying to excavate the conceptual and empirical foundations of the field of evidence, actually beginning before I even was thinking in terms of complex adaptive systems. But a lot of the things that have already been generated are quite consistent with this. The reason, as you know, I pointed out that belief among especially epistemologists that there's something wrong with naked statistics is just wrong. And one of the reasons why is it's just absolutely crazy to think that a system would deprive itself of really valuable evidence like that. The hearsay rule is a rule of admission, is consistent with the idea that what we're attempting to do is facilitate the parties to deal with this complex system. And as you know, probably the work that I'm most known for is the relative plausibility theory, where I think we've established that the best explanation, again, explanation of trials and litigation systems is not probabilistic, but explanatory. All of these things led together to the next step, which is, well, guess what? What's going on here is the system is tolerating, not only tolerating, it's actually demanding active adversarial engagement. This has really radical implications for criminal cases. So where does this go next? Well, the projects that I'm working on are a little bit disparate, but I think the best explanation of the common law is as a complex adaptive system. And I may start shopping, if you will, a paper that says that. I'm a little concerned that it's just pouring old wine into new bottles. I think it has some insights. But one that's going to interest you is I'm going to be able to demonstrate that you have no idea what proof beyond reasonable doubt is, that the effect of any instruction on proof beyond reasonable doubt is going to be completely affected by the evidentiary regime. Compare two sets of cases that are identical, except in one case, there's comment on the evidence. Well, what that does is it pushes the probability curves one direction or the other, and thus you've changed the functional burden of persuasion. Every single evidence rule does that. States have different evidentiary regimes. That means what beyond reasonable doubt or preponderance of the evidence, we're just using beyond reasonable doubt because it catches people's attention, has different privileges, for example. Well, that means it's going to be harder in one state than another to make a case, even though you have the exact same evidence. So you have no idea what these proof standards actually are. And what I mean by that, the effect that they have. And again, that's because, and this is probably the most direct application of complexity theory, a lot of the other work is more inspired by it, is because of the complex adaptive nature of the system. So those are the directions that things seem to be going at the moment.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, Ron, a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today to talk about minimalist and maximalist views of evidence law. Great having you on the show.
Thank you, Ed. It's always a pleasure to see you and to talk to you. Take care. And I love this program that you and Alex are running.
The dichotomy between maximalist and minimalist theories of evidence that's proposed by Ron and his co-authors is undoubtedly a useful framework for understanding not only our current system, but also the tensions that sometimes arise in it. Whenever we want to leave things to the fact finder and the adversarial system, we're embracing minimalism. And whenever we want to improve the fact finding through the rules, then we are effectively embracing maximalism. On the whole, Ron is surely right that empirically, the current evidentiary system that we have is minimalist. Relevancy is minimalist. So is deference to the fact finder on sufficiency. And even hearsay and the character rules seem minimalist once you consider how extremely porous they really are. But remember, this is a description of the world as it currently stands. It's not necessarily what we want evidence law to be. And as Alex Nunn noted to me, it's not even necessarily the case that it's what the federal rules of evidence aspires to. If we ask the rule writers what they were trying to do, would they say they were trying for minimal rationality? I kind of doubt it. So it's interesting. Minimal rationality may be more a symptom of evidence law's failure than anything else. Ron, for his part, seems to think that minimalism is inevitable because we can't codify the process of inference. But I suspect many of us dream differently. We dream of doing more than ensuring minimal rationality. We dream of actually improving legal fact-finding. In any event, as we might expect from Ron, a super interesting conceptual paper. And for the evidence scholars out there listening, ask yourself, are you an evidence minimalist or are you a maximalist? Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The associate producer is Alex Nunn, and the production editor is Anirudh Morella. Additional production assistance is provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Ed Chang. And I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another new work in the world of evidence and proof.